Blog Talk Radio. Good evening. Thank you for joining us on Challenging the Rhetoric. Any other show by this name is a duplication or fabrication. That music was a little bit of the Haitian rah-rah drums from last season's Carnival. Our mission statement is News by Women for Women. You can find us at challengingtherhetoric.com. The same name is our Facebook page, and on Twitter we are Rhetoric versus Facts. That's rhetoric spelled out, then VS Facts. And two other hashtags we use are Challenging the Rhetoric and CTR. Tonight is Wednesday, August 26, 2015, and we're doing we're going to rebroadcast an awesome interview that I did with Dadee Sherry. It was originally aired on Wise Women Media Radio on August 5th. And Miss Sherry will be speaking about her new book, We Have Dared to Be Free, Haiti's Struggle Against Occupation. This book took 5 years to write, is published by News Junkie Post Press, and it is about the humanitarian occupation currently taking place in Haiti. Tonight is part one. Parts two and three will be aired Thursday and Friday night, same time, 6:30 p.m. That's Eastern time. And those shows will be archived. So without further ado, let me go ahead and start the audio and enjoy. I do have the chat open. This broadcast will be half an hour. So if you have any questions, just hit me up in the chat room. Here we go.
Tonight, our special guest is Dadee Sherry. She is a PhD, an author, journalist, activist, and broadcaster. She has spent a number of years writing with News Junkie Post. She also has her own website at Dadee Sherry, DadeeSherry.com. News Junkie Post is now branching out into publishing for this work of Dadee Sherry, her book, which is titled We Have Dared to Be Free, Haiti's Struggle Against Occupation, will be the first published book through the new News Junkie Post Press, or NJP Press. Let me just go ahead and give a little background. Most Americans do not know a lot about Haiti, its rich history, the culture, and the ties to France, the past and present resistance, and the ongoing occupation. Many Americans have only heard about voodoo. I don't know why this is, but I'll just open with that as my first question. Dadee Sherry, thank you for joining us tonight. And
It's a pleasure. It's a pleasure to be on Wise Women Media.
Thank you. I've already read the foreword to the book, and let me tell you, I think it's going to be one of those books I can't put down. So I'm really, really excited about it. And I had just told you in the pre-interview, I've probably read more about the history of Haiti than most of my colleagues or counterparts, simply because it was an object of interest because of the art. I have a background, a Francophone background, and that drew me to the history of the island. But since voodoos will hear about the spiritual belief system of the people, let me open with a question from that, and then we can move on. What would be some of the common misconceptions that people have, especially Americans, about this belief system? Because I find that it's very beautiful and earth-centered. Can you kind of break it down so Americans understand it a little bit better?
Yeah, well, they think it is superstition, it's the dark arts, balls with little pins in them and so on. It is not that at all. It is actually a way of life. It is a religion that celebrates the ancestors and that celebrates the history of the Haitian slaves. So they were brought to Haiti, who were the venerable ancestors who actually got them through this voyage and who actually contributed to Haitian agriculture. There is a lot of food in voodoo. I mean, voodoo is so connected to agriculture that the voodoo ceremonies are called manger loa, which means food for the gods. And the voodoo gods eat local food. It grounds people in the local agriculture. It grounds venerating what they need for a sustainable life. That's really what the religion is about. And I think ultimately that's what most religions start out being about. And then eventually they become more and more abstract. But voodoo is so intertwined with Haitian life that people who practice voodoo don't even know that's what they're doing.
Because it's so earth-centered and so much like nature. I mean, I related a lot to the certain traditions within Santeria and Candomblé, very, very pagan-centric, earth-centric.
Absolutely. The trees have spirits, and the dead are very much alive. You know, you can appeal to them, you can talk, you can call them forth and ask them for advice. And literally bring them back. You know, you have these possessions with these personalities who then advise the participating crowd. I like joy, you know, I'm into joy. It's an incredibly joyful religion. You can dance with your gods, you know, the music is good.
I love the music. I love the music. And one of the bands that I've actually listened to quite a bit, since they are francophone, and I know that they give a lot of their money to a lot of different organizations that are working within Haiti is Arcade Fire, and they have actually sat down on video and explained a lot about the music that comes out of Haiti and how there's many, many people that live there that don't even know who the Beatles are, but yet you'll be just moved to dance when you hear the rah-rah drums. So I have so I've never heard of the rah-rah drums until they were talking about it on this interview, and I happened to look them up on YouTube, and anywhere where there's like a francophone population, like Montreal, there were people with the rah-rah drums in Montreal playing. That was beautiful.
I think that kind of religion where you can actually bring back an ancestor because of the dance and because of the drums, because of the trance. I think it's absolutely beautiful, I love the joy. I love the fact that it celebrates life. Edward Abbey said, half the world's religions are afraid of life and the other half are afraid of death. And I think voodoo is neither.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not afraid of life and it's not afraid of death. It's not afraid of sex. There aren't all these prescriptions about sex and so on. It doesn't really meddle into people's sex lives and sexual preferences. None of that. It's about how you live sustainably.
Right, and so connected to the earth itself. You said in the foreword of your book that two of the sustaining things about the Haitian people and that have kept them sustainable is their belief in voodoo, but also their family structure. Tell us how the family structure would be different than what we know here in America.
Well, the family structure in Haiti is extremely extended. You grow up in a family, and you know, if you're a kid, you know, all the adult males more or less behave like your father, and the adult females behave like your mother. And if you grow up in a family that's very poor, for example, they can recruit family. If your mother has a good friend, you know, she will make sure that her good friends, maybe a little bit more prosperous, will actually become your godparents, like your godmother and your godfather. And it's actually something quite serious. It means that if the mother becomes incapacitated, there are lots of mothers, and they're the godparents. The children are never, you know, talk about orphans in Haiti and islands, you know. When I heard all this stuff about orphans after the earthquake, well, I was just shocked. First of all, in an earthquake, children die. When buildings collapse, children die, and adults are maimed. Adults get all these horrible, you know, they get amputated and assorted other things. And so you wind up with parents without children, not children without parents usually.
Right.
Okay. And so you had all this stuff about all these supposed orphans who didn't have children, but then if you look, who didn't have parents, but then if you look more closely at the whole thing, what they're calling orphans in Haiti are poor people who are kind of lured into putting their kids in these places. They're called orphanages, but of course, these are Haitians, and I don't even know what orphanage means in English. So they bring their kids there, make sure their kids get fed, and they get schooled. People are very into having their kids get schooled. And so there are a lot of these places that are extremely unscrupulous, and they just kind of sit there. And they're in a lot of poor countries. They just wait for an opportunity. They wait. They wait for war, an earthquake, a flood, you name it. And then they scoop these children. We're sending all these orphans. Everybody thinks, oh, how wonderful. And then they scoop these children away. These children actually have parents.
Okay. So what you were saying in the very beginning was that it takes a village to raise a child. That's a good thing. That's a beautiful, loving thing where everybody takes on the role, like, say, an extended family takes on the role of parents. Or uncles or aunts or older cousins, or so the child is surrounded by this wonderful family.
Absolutely.
But then the organizations come in. And let me ask you this, since this is one of the horrible things of any crisis situation like the earthquake or with war. Do you believe that a lot of this was child trafficking, that this was done with intent?
Absolutely, it was. And there were these incredible instances where, you know, there were these children in Pennsylvania, for example, who were undocumented. And everybody was saying, oh, well, you know, they're better off in the United States anyway. And for a child to be undocumented in this situation is extraordinary because there's just so much corruption in Haiti. You could usually manage to get somebody to just, you know, fiddle with some papers and put some stamps on them and you're off. But these children were completely undocumented. They were wetting their beds. They were having all sorts of psychological problems. This was actually reported in the news in the United States. These kids had obviously sent out from Haiti to Pennsylvania. And then there was, of course, the case of Laura Silsby, who was intercepted trying to take some children to the Dominican Republic. She was never actually tried or really convicted of anything. But 22 out of these 33 children that she had with her, that she was taking to the Dominican Republic, had parents, had at least one living parent. And this is happening within the context of the earthquake.
So the parents or the extended family trying to do the right thing are giving the children over to these so-called organizations, mainly just to get them fed and in school, because they knew with the whole system breakdown after the earthquake, and it could be in any other country, it could be a volcano, or it could be a tsunami, or it could be war, or whatever. This is what the parents, the desperate parents, are going to do. They're of course going to make sure their children are fed. That's number one. Fed,
This is actually even, sorry to interrupt, this is actually even before the earthquake. They kind of lure the parents into, you know, you can bring your kids over, and everybody wants their kids to go to school. They want their kids' situation to be improved compared to theirs and so on. So you more for the education than anything, you bring your kid over, and, you know, we'll have class, they'll get lunch, and they'll get breakfast and so on. And then when there is the earthquake, they just pack up all the orphans, the so-called orphans, and take them away.
Oh, my goodness. This is just, you know, I knew this was happening because, you know, remember when the tsunami happened on the other side of the globe, somebody was actually doing this, making a phone call, and I believe somebody broadcasted it on CNN. That somebody had said on the phone that there was 30 children available and they were making plans to get them out. And in my mind, I knew exactly what was going on, that they were trafficking these children, and there would be no move to try to find out if these children had living relatives. They were just going to take them.
There were so many children removed from Haiti the year of the earthquake that the biggest adoption agency in the United States, their adoption rate went up 26%.
Oh, my word.
That's bad. Yes.
Yeah. That's just proof of something crooked right there.
You know?
Have to look, and then you have to follow the money, because then as soon as you follow the money and the profits, then you know there's a malefic angle to this. And, of course, it's not going to be the outside story, the one we're going to hear about here.
Another thing about adoption that most people don't know is, according to Haitian law, until summer 2012, the only adoptions that were considered legal in Haiti were actually partial adoptions. So these were the kinds of adoptions that people would normally do, which is where you have maybe one children too many, and you really can't support them. And so you call on their godmother, for example, to help you out, and they go and they live with a godparent, or it might be just a friend. And this is considered a token of friendship. It's something that's done between friends, and it doesn't involve money. Okay? And the kid does light work around the house. The kid, you know, does work around the garden, or makes the beds, or does the dishes. And in return, they get room and board, okay? And the parents together collaborate on getting things like clothing and schooling and all of that for the kid. And this, the kid, and this is usually not a baby either, it's usually a teenage child, the child then eventually actually goes back to the biological parent. And it just kind of expands the family of that person. The kind of adoption that was considered legal in Haiti. The child knows the biological parent, knows the adoptive parent, the parents communicate.
They did that in Europe a lot of times with when you study history in Europe, like a lot of times a child would call it fostering out. And a lot of times it would be the child that needed to learn a skill. He would go and live with an uncle and learn the skill, or he would go and live with somebody else, and they would teach him about the military, or he would learn something in school. But they called it fostering out, and more often than not, it was a male child.
Uh-huh.
Of course, they didn't believe in teaching women, you know.
This is very interesting. In a way, I think Haiti is sort of where Europe was really before the Industrial Revolution.
Right.
In that sense. you know, we kind of maintained a lot of the original traditions of the island, and they were obviously sustainable, you know. And then you have all these foreigners who come around and think they know better. They're going to change everything to their own system.
Right.
You know? And it just really just does not work. And it's full of abuses, too. You know?
Now, going on to the next topic, we were going to talk a little bit about Clinton and all these other movers and shakers in Haiti, including the role of some of the NGOs. But let's start with Clinton. Why has he made Haiti his sole project?
Yes, well, I would like to know that. Supposedly, he discovered Haiti during some sort of pleasure trip, I think possibly his honeymoon, and then decided he loved Haiti so much that he was going to ruin it, unfortunately for us.
Right.
but really, what Clinton is doing is nothing new. Haiti was occupied by the United States between 1915 and 1934.
Right.
Yeah, it was. And during that occupation, you know, they offered the Haitian president a deal, and it was basically that basically all the jobs in Haiti were not going to go to, all the important jobs, all the sort of white-collar jobs would go to Americans. Okay? Haiti's 40% of the national budget would go to the United States.
Wow.
Yes. And there would be the president, which was kind of the U.S. handpicked president, and also what was called the U.S. High Commissioner of Haiti. Okay, and then it was a General Russell who was set up as the U.S. High Commissioner of Haiti. So basically, one could think of Clinton as the current U.S. High Commissioner of Haiti. It really is, you know, is not that creative, the setup. It's been done. And the people, the foreigners, they were basically American white southerners who were Democrats, who had supported Woodrow Wilson during his presidency. Okay, so now instead of that, you've got the NGOs. Okay.
And people would say that the NGOs are there to help the people. And, of course, you say that the NGOs are not good for Haiti. And explain why that is. So, because I know some of our listeners probably wouldn't even understand that. I understand it, but,
They're not good for Haiti. I think, you know, some of these people may be well-meaning, but ultimately the reason why they're in Haiti is because Haiti is lawless. It is a place where they can experiment. They can do whatever they like. And that in itself is not good. But importantly, though, most of them are getting money somehow, one way or another, from USAID.
Okay.
And USAID brags about the fact that 80% of the money that gets paid to these people, which is, of course, tax-free, okay, is spent in the United States. It comes back to the U.S.
Wow.
So being a poet, I can't help but think about this that way. I think, you know, all these people who live in Haiti is their excreta, and it's sort of like poetic justice that Haiti wound up with a cholera epidemic from the foreign invasion, because that is all they leave. Come to Haiti, and another thing they do that I find that is not at all helpful is that if this is the reason why the USAID encourages them, is that they function as a buffer, they function as a block between the leadership and the people. Normally, so what I mean by this is if you have a government that's improbable, you have an occupation government, and you are trying to have a revolution, you're trying to have a change, what you want to establish is a government in waiting. You want to be providing medical services. You want be providing schooling. You want to basically have a government ready.
Right.
You cannot do that if you have a bunch of NGOs that are you know, just doing all of this.
We will leave that there. That was part one of our interview with Dadee Sherry on her wonderful book on Haiti, We Have Dared to Be Free, Haiti's Struggle Against Occupation. Thanks for listening in. I do want to let you all know we're on Facebook and we are on Twitter. Give us a like and a follow on Challenging the Rhetoric on Facebook. On Twitter, we are at Rhetoric Versus Facts. You can see more about us, our other shows, stories, articles at challengingtherhetoric.com. And if you feel so inclined, give a little at the GoFundMe link to help keep us on the air. That is linked up on our site. If you would like to join us as a contributor, leave us a message also on the website, and we will get in touch with you. Part two of this interview will be aired tomorrow night at 6:30 p.m. Eastern. I want to thank you all for listening in, and we will take it out with a little bit more of the rah-rah drums. Good night, everyone. Thank you.
Bye.